Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow, of course, Wednesday, we'll be looking at politics as we do on Wednesdays. Donna Hoffman will be with us of the University of Northern Iowa, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, two able analysts who will be looking at a number of things. Of course, we'll talk about the George H.W. Bush funeral that is happening tomorrow, but also new developments I'm seeing on my screen. Michael Flynn sentencing memo expected today. News from the Russia probe keeps coming. We'll cover that all tomorrow on River to River. Well, it's been 4 days since the powerful earthquake in Alaska. That was on Friday, a 7.0 magnitude quake striking Friday morning about 8 miles north of Anchorage. That's the state's largest city. 300,000 residents in Anchorage disrupted rush hour traffic, jammed the telephone service. Thankfully, no reports of serious injuries. Even on the weekend, aftershocks from that Friday quake continuing in the area around Anchorage. Buckling roads, roads needing repairs. Residents began clearing up the damage around their homes, their businesses. Let's get a couple of perspectives on the quake this hour, starting with Steve Cannon. He's an Iowan who is or was in Alaska. He felt the earthquake on Friday. Steve, welcome to the program.
Great to be here and still in Alaska.
You are still. Whereabouts?
I'm in Fairbanks.
You're in Fairbanks. Okay, so tell us, where were you when the earthquake happened Friday morning?
I was in my cabin just a little bit north of Fairbanks, so I'm a good 100 miles plus from Anchorage, and that's when the cabin started rocking side to side.
Okay, so were you asleep? Were you awake? What did you think?
I just finished my morning meditation, and I thought maybe I'd access some new powers. I was fairly early in the morning. Like you said, it was kind of rush hour-ish in Anchorage. But from Iowa, you know, we just don't have those things. So it's not a top-of-the-mind thing where I've since come to find out that smaller earthquakes are pretty regular here. But I literally ran downstairs thinking I was going to get the greatest viral video of all time, that there must be some bull moose gone crazy that was trying to tip over my cap. And I mean, literally it was swaying side to side enough to probably make you nauseous if it would have kept up.
Really? So you're on the second floor, you race down. What else are you seeing when you come down? Are you seeing books falling, anything falling off shelves, that kind of thing?
You know, it was right on the verge of that. and at the time, it's still dark here at that time. It's still dark here right now. We're approaching our shortest day of the year, which will be, you know, 3.5 hours of light. So, you know, you could see a bit, but there was no bull moose. And I looked to the wind and there was no 80-mile-an-hour winds. And again, it's just not top of the mind for a guy from Iowa. And, you know, and then, you know, I'm looking and you can see the wind chimes swaying back and forth and the cabin is still rocking to and fro. And so it was right about the time it stopped where I thought, oh my goodness, I think I just sat through my first earthquake.
No bull moose.
No bull moose. And for all those people in Anchorage and the people that were affected by it, I so wish I would have got the big viral video, because it really turned out to be quite a destructive thing. I think the biggest earthquake in 50 since 1964.
Oh, really? How many seconds did it last, do you think?
I think here it was a good 10 to 15 seconds, which, again, not really knowing what was going on, it was just really unnerving, I suppose. Where it was so much worse, and many people have seen the videos, I have too. I'm sure that seemed like an eternity in Anchorage, where it really hit.
Yeah, Steve, you were, as you said, 100 miles to the north of, more or less to the north of Anchorage, where the epicenter was close. That was the epicenter a little bit north of Anchorage, which is to the south of where you are more or less located, Fairbanks, right?
That's correct.
Bill Barnhart is with us as well, assistant professor of the University of Iowa's department in the University of Iowa's Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. Bill, welcome back to the program. Last time we talked, we were talking about volcanoes in Hawaii when that was the news of the day.
We're just trying to avoid the lower 48 right now, I guess.
So you heard, welcome to the program, you heard Steve's description of what went on. Tell us more about this earthquake from your scientific point of view. How would you classify it? What happened?
Well, this is a very big earthquake. A magnitude 7 is, you know, not a small event. The earthquake, so Alaska is the most seismically active state in the United States. So people there are very used to that. The earthquakes there are driven or dominated by a process called subduction, where the Pacific plate that underlies the entire Pacific Ocean dives down underneath of Alaska to the north.
It's the same plate that's in all along the California, Oregon, Washington?
Exactly. So same plate. And so that dominates the earthquakes. Now, this earthquake is a little different in that it doesn't happen at that boundary. As that plate dives down, it bends. It's bending as it dives down into the earth, and that can cause the plate to break. And that's what this earthquake was. And that's why it was so close to the city of Anchorage itself rather than closer to the coastlines.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about typically, I've heard, you know, when you talk about earthquakes, this one plate slipping across the next one, tension building up, and then that tension released. This was not that. This was a breakage.
Right. So this is what's called a intraslab earthquake. So it happens within the plate itself. So it's similar to earthquakes that occur away from plate boundaries. It's related to the plate tectonic processes, but it's actually occurring within the plate instead of at the boundary. And even though this was a magnitude 7 earthquake, it's much smaller than what happens when you have slip at those boundaries. The 1964 earthquake was brought up, which was about a magnitude 9.2 earthquake, and is also the second largest known earthquake ever in the world. So
where did that take place?
In southern Alaska.
In southern Alaska.
That's the Good Friday earthquake of 1964.
Okay. Talking about seismology this hour with Bill Barnhart. He's an earth and environmental science professor at the University of Iowa. Steve Cannon, an Iowan, was in Alaska, felt the earthquake last Friday, 7.0, epicenter just north of Anchorage, Alaska. Join us with your earthquake experience, 1-866-780-9100. Tree is with us from Des Moines. He's answered our call. Tree, you have an earthquake experience to share?
Yeah, just an interesting story. Back in the 60s, when I was a young teenager in Wisconsin living on a farm, there was a earthquake in the middle of the night. I didn't realize it was an earthquake until years later. And what it was is that my bed, as I was sleeping, it rocked or undulated, I guess would be the way to describe it. And I found out later from a geologist, when you have instead of having a shaking earthquake, you have an undulating earthquake, that means you're very close to the epicenter. Turns out, one of the fences, barbed wire fence rows on my farm has a jog in it. It had a jog in it back then. And I later on happened to be at the museum in Milwaukee and saw a map of earthquakes in Wisconsin and saw that, yes, indeed, there's a fault line that goes through our farm.
Oh, so you... every time you see that fence, you say, "That I know where that came from."
Yeah, exactly. So I thought, I wouldn't think of earthquakes in Wisconsin, but we had one.
Tree, thank you very much for your experience calling from Des Moines. Tell us, Bill, how common are earthquakes here in the Midwest?
You know, that's become a complicated question since, say, 2010. In general, earthquakes are exceedingly rare here in the Midwest. I'm not aware of any earthquakes documented in the state of Iowa. There are earthquake zones such as the New Madrid seismic zone along the Mississippi River. But more recently, in states like Oklahoma and Kansas, there's been very rapid increases in the number of earthquakes. For the last few years, Oklahoma has actually been the second most seismically active state in the U.S. rather than California. And these are due to what's called induced seismicity, so human-caused earthquakes.
Fracking.
Sort of. It's actually more wastewater injection. So fracking generates wastewater, and that gets injected into the earth to sequester the fluids, and that can destabilize faults and cause earthquakes. One of those was actually felt widely throughout Iowa in September of 2016. It was a magnitude 5.8 earthquake, which is about 62 times smaller than the Alaska magnitude 7 earthquake. But here in the Midwest, seismic waves can propagate very efficiently, so you can feel smaller earthquakes over a very broad area. So people throughout Iowa reported feeling that earthquake.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you mentioned the measurement here, because a 7.0 in Anchorage compared to a 5.4 or 5.2, that's not just a little bit more, right? Talk about that scale.
It's a lot more. So on the moment magnitude scale, as you go up a magnitude, say from a magnitude 6 to a magnitude 7 earthquake, it scales by a factor of 33 in times of the size of the earthquake. So a magnitude 7 earthquake is 33 times larger than a magnitude 6 and about 1,000 times larger than a magnitude 5. So that scale can be a little misleading, but a magnitude 7 is substantially larger than earthquakes that we typically see here in the Midwest.
Why measure it that way if it's hard to kind of conceptualize?
Well, the way we actually measure it is with a horrible unit called the Newton meter, which has units of like 10 to the 21st Newton meters, which is a very difficult measurement to communicate to the public. Right. So the moment magnitude scale was developed as a way to better communicate that.
Okay. Let's go back to our phones looking for earthquake experiences to share. Bill Barnhart, the University of Iowa, with us. Steve Cannon, an Iowan, joining us from Alaska today. He felt that. He thought it was a bull moose, perhaps, initially. Steve Cannon felt that he's just outside of Fairbanks, and his cabin was shaking. Corey is joining us from LaPorte City here in Iowa. Corey, you experienced an earthquake? When and where?
Yes, it was 29 Palms, California, 1999. They called it the Hector Mine earthquake, and it was around a 7.0 is
okay.
What I believe.
And how close were you to the epicenter?
It was roughly 18 to 20 miles.
Wow. You were almost on top of it.
Yes.
What did it feel like?
And I mean, it was around 2 in the morning, and I was sleeping, and it just felt like somebody was just shaking the whole building. The bed actually moved about 3 foot across the floor, and stuff was falling off the walls, and windows cracked. It was a brick barracks building. It was when I was stationed in the Marine Corps there at 29 Palms.
So what was your reaction to that change, you know, the way you go about life? Did it change anything about life after that, or did you just say, oh, earthquake, and move on with life?
Well, I just thought, do that. I didn't think they even happened in the Midwest, so I was thinking, once I came back home to Iowa, I thought, well, I'm never going to experience that again unless I go back to California.
Okay. Well, we think you're fairly safe as far as earthquakes go here, Corey, according to our seismologist. Corey, thanks for sharing your story from LaPorte City.
All right, thank you.
Bye now. So is that a well-known earthquake that Corey experienced in 1999?
The Hector Mine earthquake is very well-known, and the Hector Mine is actually an interesting story because it's widely believed that the Hector Mine earthquake was actually triggered by an earthquake that happened 7 years earlier in 1992, the Landers earthquake, which was a magnitude 7.3. Following any earthquake, you get aftershocks, so people in Anchorage are experiencing many, many aftershocks.
Right.
That's a very common process.
What are aftershocks?
They're earthquakes that are smaller than what's called the main shock, so the biggest event to occur, the magnitude 7 in this case, and they follow for weeks to decades following an earthquake, depending on how big it is. Now, in addition to aftershocks, large earthquakes change stresses in the earth, and they can stress other faults and trigger other earthquakes later. So the Hector Mine example that was just brought up has been shown to likely have been influenced by this earthquake 7 years before. So in addition to expecting aftershocks, you can also potentially expect to see bigger earthquakes or similar-sized earthquakes in the years to decades following.
Okay, back to our phones to get more earthquake experiences, firsthand experiences. Shireen, is that the way you pronounce your name? I hope so.
Yes.
Mount Vernon, welcome to the program. We're running out of time, but I hear you have an experience.
Sure, I'll be fast. In 2001, my husband and I moved from just outside the Des Moines area to Anchorage, Alaska, and lived there for 4 years. We'd been there, just about a month or two when Anchorage had one that, I can't remember, I think it was about a 2 or a 3, but for me that was a pretty big right. earthquake. I remember just hearing a huge boom, and you got to remember this is fall, winter of 2001, so not too long after 9/11.
Yes.
And so my only thought was that an airplane had just crashed somewhere. Realized that that wasn't the case, and I went running to the basement with my daughters because I was a good Iowan and prepared for tornadoes, and realized that was the worst place in the house to go to. And the funny thing was after I realized it was over, I turned on the television expecting, of course, to hear news coverage and to find what had happened. And there was no coverage of it at all because it was so common. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, what's the big deal? Why were you worried? But it was my first one.
So,
and in the 4 years we were there, we experienced many, including the one that hit near Denali in 2004. But in the Anchorage area, it really shook things up. Mm-hmm. And if I remember right, that one was a 5 or a 6.
Mm-hmm. And unlike a tornado, now you know what you do in an earthquake. You get out, right?
Well, no, we had a substantial dining room table, so instead of having what we call
you don't get time, out. I don't want to spread that out here. Okay.
No, you get in
Bill
doorway,
is looking at me
or...
like, don't say that. No, what do you do? What do you do, Bill?
I think she was going to explain it. The mantra you want to remember is drop cover and hold on if you're inside. So.
Okay.
Right, and I had little ones, so I knew I couldn't just keep them in a doorway. So we would just get underneath our dining room table, and I tried to turn that into a game.
Where did I get this idea? Is it in some countries where the structures are not very, very sound that you do want to get out of the structure, Bill?
It's what you want to avoid is falling material,
right?
Because that's what kills people during earthquakes. And the idea of drop cover and hold on is that if you have a table, you drop down underneath of that to provide shelter. You're covered by it. And then you hold on to the leg because the ground's shaking and you don't want the table to dance away from on top of you. So the goal is to protect yourself from falling debris. If you're next to the side of a building, get away from the side of the building.
Okay. Shireen, thank you very much for your remembrances from Anchorage in Mount Vernon. Shireen, I have to share I felt one earthquake in 1992. I had to look it up this morning because I had this vague memory when my daughter was just a 2-year-old girl. I lived in Germany, and I looked it up. It's the Rohrmund earthquake in 92. This is April 13th, 92. And the time actually perfectly matches up with my memories. I was woken around 3:30 in the morning, shaken out of bed by this, and didn't have any idea what it is. So different fault lines at work in Europe.
Yes, exactly. And again, it's not a active plate boundary there. So that would be similar to earthquakes you might feel in the Midwest. Fairly rare events, but earthquakes do happen just about everywhere.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. Roger joining us with, I think, another experience of a trembler, not in Cedar Rapids, but where were you, Roger?
We were living in Costa Rica.
What
I
did
was
you...
on a Fulbright, and we had the family along, and about 11:30, my 5th grader and my 10th grader both came running, and we all did go outside. Costa Rica actually has pretty good construction guidelines. We were in a single-story home, and there wasn't much need to get out. We went outside, and it was a 6.2. We were on the northeast side of the city, and the center was in the southwest, about 30 miles away.
Did you know immediately?
But it was very strange. I remember as we were walking out, it felt like the floor was spinning around me.
So you knew immediately what it was, though?
Oh, yeah, we were pretty sure. We had been anticipating one, and I've been many times with students from college and never experienced one, but we all were certain that's what it was when it came.
All right. Roger in Cedar Rapids, thank you so much for sharing your experience.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye now. Okay. Steve Cannon, I want to go back to you. You're in Alaska. Very quickly, we don't have much time. What's an Iowan doing in Alaska? You're training, right?
I am. I'm taking on the human-powered version of the I did a Rod sled dog race in the end of February, so I'll be here getting ready for that event.
Okay, this is an amazing event. I don't know if there's a more challenging physical event than this. You say human powered. This is a bike. You're on a fat tire bike?
That's right. That's right. They have a human powered version of the sled dog race. So it's a 1,000-mile self-supported event from Anchorage to the Bering Sea, a small little village called Nome.
A 1,000 miles. So this is like several Ragbri's without
the pie.
Without the pie. Without the vendors. It's not in July. It's in January. Or
February.
February. It's in February. In February. Yeah. So this is just grit your teeth and endure.
Yeah, it's I think depending on where you read that it's listed certainly as one of the most difficult endurance events in the world, and I was here last winter training for the 350-mile version, and they want to make sure you can keep all your fingers and toes before they'll let you out on the full 1,000-mile, but it's an amazing event, and you get to see some amazing country, and if I do my work properly and learn how to handle myself up here, I'm hoping that it will be more enjoyable than suffering.
Okay. You did the 350-mile race. We wish you all the best in conquering the 1,000-miler. Steve Cannon joining us from Alaska, talking mainly about an earthquake. But I don't know, would you rather be in an earthquake or go 1,000 miles on? There's a question for us to ponder. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Bill Barnhart, thanks for coming into our studio again and telling us a little bit about the earthquake in Alaska and about the tectonics.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me again.
Of the world, the Midwest, the West Coast. Thanks again. Hope to see you again. And we'll, when it has to do with the Earth's crust, I guess we'll call Bill.
Perfect.
Okay. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Tune in tomorrow for Politics Wednesday.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, in the second half hour, we want to find out how many of our listeners have experienced an earthquake. One that you could feel, a significant earthquake, perhaps not in the Midwest. Of course, the Midwest not really known for earthquakes, but we will talk about the last time we had an earthquake here in the Midwest. But if you've experienced an earthquake, we'd like you to share that. In our second half hour, we'll be digging into seismology following last Friday's powerful earthquake in Alaska. We'll hear from an Iowan who was in Alaska. He experienced it, and we'll hear about that. Also, we'll hear from an earth and environmental scientist at the University of Iowa. But first, back in November, citizens of Florida approved a constitutional amendment that slates an end to greyhound racing in that state by 2021. Well, the significance of that is that Sunshine State is home to 11 of the country's 17 remaining greyhound tracks. More than half of the country's greyhound tracks are in Florida, and they are closing shop there in Florida by 2021. Iowa is home to one greyhound racing track. That's Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque. It's the only remaining greyhound racing track in the Midwest. So how will Florida's phasing out of greyhound racing impact dog racing here in Iowa? How will Florida's move affect the numbers of dogs at breeders and kennels across the U.S.? We're going to put these questions and others to our guests this hour. Let's first welcome Jim Gartland, Executive Director of the National Greyhound Association. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Must be a big disappointment, this vote in Florida, for you.
Yeah, in more ways than one. It was a battle we knew was coming and thought we had a good chance of winning. And unfortunately, I think through some misleading kind of information and advertising. We went down to defeat, but we'll have to deal with it now that it's done.
Mm-hmm. And it's a once and for all vote. That is the end of it. There's no do-overs.
Well, as a vote, yes. We're looking into some legal and legislative alternatives, but that's something that's going to be down the road. Right now, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm. The campaign reports that I'm seeing said that the Florida campaign to end greyhound racing was waged around concerns for animal rights. And I assume this is what you were referring to. Now, some people are saying that animals are not treated so well when they're take part in greyhound racing. You don't have that opinion, I assume.
Obviously not. We treat these animals better than I would say the majority of people in America treat their pets. It makes no sense to take an animal that is an athlete that you make your living off of and mistreat it. These are athletes. They run. They love to run. And they're very well taken care of, and they have to be in good shape to race. And so a lot of the information that was put out there we thought was very misleading. Some of it was out-and-out false. And we take great pride in the care we give our animals.
Okay. That campaign is over. Let's talk about what happens now. Tell us more about the phasing out in Florida by 2021 of their greyhound tracks. Step by step, what will happen here?
Well, the tracks were given the option to stop racing, actually, at the end of this year, all 11 tracks. And racing must not be too bad because 8 of the 11 tracks have decided to continue racing until the ultimate deadline of December 31st of 2020. So there's no immediate panic to be had. It's kind of business as usual. Eventually, there'll be a phase out of racing down there. As the years go on, if we get closer to that 2020 deadline, there'll be less and less greyhounds sent to Florida to race, obviously, and the ones that remain there, what few, I would say, probably remain there at the time, will be adopted out by our agency working with the Greyhound Pets of America and adoption groups throughout the country.
Mm-hmm. Is this potentially, Jim, the beginning of the end of greyhound racing in the United States? Is this the beginning of a collapse?
I don't think so. It's part of a trend that's been going down in racing for years. We still have racing in 5 or 6 states, and we still have racing available to be had in numerous other states. The state I'm in right now, Kansas, for example, permits greyhound racing. Currently, there's no tracks open, but there has been bills run in the legislature the last couple of years to get those tracks back opened up. So that's a possibility, but we still have racing in West Virginia and Arkansas and Alabama and Texas and Iowa. So mm-hmm. It's not the end of it, but it certainly isn't a help, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk to hear from some Iowa voices in just a moment, but what's your national view on what this means for Iowa's sole greyhound racing track in Dubuque?
Well, I don't think it means the end of anything for Iowa. Iowa has always been a seasonal, Iowa Greyhound Parks have been a seasonal operation, and I think we'll continue to do so. I can't speak for them, but I believe they may be seeking out some partners in the industry to maybe run some sort of a home-and-home type racing seasons with. You'll have to ask them that. Iowa's always been a great state for racing, and unfortunately, the Florida debacle has an effect on all of the country because there's greyhound farmers in Iowa and Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas and all over that raise greyhounds to race in Florida. And all those people now are going to have to take a hard look at their operations, whether they cut back significantly or get out of the business altogether.
Jim Gartland is Executive Director of the National Greyhound Association, joining us this half hour as we discuss Florida's decision back in November. They had a constitutional amendment that was approved that slates an end to greyhound racing by 2021, by the last day of 2020. They will close shop there in Florida. There, 11 of the country's 17 greyhound tracks are in Florida, 1 in Iowa, in Dubuque. Brian Carpenter is Director of Racing and General Manager of the Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
What is your shade of disappointment here in the news from Florida for your industry?
Well, I have to admit, I am very surprised. I thought Florida would be the tracks would be around forever. But, you know, it does affect us, obviously. But like Jim said, there's still eight tracks that'll keep going for the next 2 years, so we won't know the impact right away until those tracks end up closing. But we are looking at what we are going to do for the future. Mm-hmm. The biggest effect on a lot of us is what during the 6 months of off season where the dogs will be going, we have to look in and try to help out the kennels of where they'll run during the winter seasons.
So your dogs that run here during the warmer months head down to Florida. Is that the way it works?
Well, we run May through October, and we have several kennels that are at different year-round tracks across the country. But then we have about three or four that will be affected that are running down in Florida at this time, and then they'll have to try to figure out where to go when the other Florida tracks end up closing.
Mm-hmm. So a game plan is in the making right now. You're sort of working on that, the possibilities.
Well, there's discussion right now of what the different options is. I mean, there is no set thing set right now. The board, the IGA board, is talking about what they should do and looking into different ideas.
Mm-hmm. Let's also welcome Jason Hess. He's Extreme Hess Racing Kennel owner, also a board member of the Iowa Greyhound Association. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is yours is a family business, isn't it? You've been having this business in your family for a long time, raising greyhounds.
Yes, my grandpa started back in the 80s, and my parents, my aunt and uncle, and now me and my brother, we've all been in it mm-hmm. pretty much our whole life.
What does this Florida's decision mean to you? What have been the discussions in your family and family business?
It hurts. We're going to definitely cut back on the amount of dogs we're breeding because with less tracks coming, it takes about 18 months when puppies start racing, so almost 2 years after breeding them, and that's right when Florida's going to be ending. Mm-hmm. But we do have some tracks left, so we're still going to be operational and looking at different avenues for Iowa down the road.
Mm-hmm. Since we talked about the Florida campaign, animal rights advocates being behind the campaign to end greyhound racing, one of the factors ending greyhound racing in Florida, obviously they were successful in that. Take us through for a dog in your kennel, the life of a racing dog, from a puppy through to racing day, the day-to-day care. Tell us, what is life like for that puppy?
Well, in the race kennel, the dogs go outside to go to the bathroom, play around for 4 or 5 hours a day. They get exercised a lot. We feed them the best food we can, the best medical stuff, because like Jim said, we do make a living off of them, and they are athletes, so they have to stay in peak condition. We go through personally a lot of treats in the kennel. They get rewarded. That's a good way dogs learn, is by getting rewarded on stuff. And puppies, I have two kids, a 2- and a 4-year-old, and they will go sit in the stalls with the moms with the little babies for hours. Mm-hmm. They absolutely love them. I have people come over all the time, adoption group people, that they'll bring 5 to 7 people over and stay for hours on the farm playing with the dogs.
Is there any issue, horse racing, the injuries and so forth, that are especially a threat to racing dogs?
Yeah, very few injuries. I mean, from statistics standpoint, it is very minute, but they do happen. It's like anything. They're athletes. They're running. They're competing. Injuries happen, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's just a part of it. But when they do, we take care of them. They get medical treatment. You do surgeries on broken bones. They get to vets immediately. We have a vet on site during racing the entire time in case anything does happen. There's a vet right there.
And tell us, how long is the racing career of a typical greyhound?
I would say about 2.5 years. They run to 4. 4.5, maybe 5, but I would say the average is probably 4 years old, and they start racing about 1.5 years old, 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
About 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. And when they retire, what happens then?
We have a about a 98% adoption rate in the industry, and there's hundreds of Greyhound adoption agencies throughout the country that are pro racing, and we give them the Greyhounds, or some come back home for breeding purposes.
Mm-hmm. So you don't buy the arguments that this is exploiting the animals, the dogs are suffering when they're being trained, made to run, and that they aren't being taken care of after they're done racing. These are some of the complaints.
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. They're animals, they love to run. They're just born that way. You can't make them run. They just, even 8, 9, 10-year-old greyhounds that are pets want to run. Mm-hmm. And the forcing them to run is just far-fetched. They are very well taken care of. That's another misleading aspect of it. And our adoption rate has to be one of the best in the country for any animal.
Mm-hmm. And when they're adopted, I've heard they have a great temperament, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. And they're in kennels. They've been trained. So people that get the Greyhounds absolutely love them. They're great with kids, and they're calm, docile. They don't shed much for being in a house.
Mm-hmm. And Jim Gartland, Executive Director of the National Greyhound Association, this has been a very successful part of your industry, isn't it, adopting Greyhounds who are done with their racing careers?
Yeah, they've become very popular all across the country. You'll see Greyhounds from California to New York. And as Jason said, we have about a 98% adoption rate. And there's a lot of Greyhounds that retire from racing that go back to their original homes to be used for breeding or to live out their lives there as well. So we're very proud of the group, the work that has been done in the adoption community over the years.
Mm-hmm. Brian Carpenter, Director of Racing, General Manager at Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque. Tell us some more of the factors that have led to the decline in Greyhound racing. When I head up to, my hometown, Cedar Falls, I pass right by an old Greyhound track that has now just recently been demolished. When was the heyday of Greyhound racing?
Well, I would say quite a few years back, before the casinos all opened up, the riverboats and everything. We were doing very well here in Dubuque, Iowa, here, but, you know, we're right next door to Wisconsin, which then Wisconsin opened up, flooded the market with 5 dog tracks at one time, and that kind of hurt everybody. And then the riverboat casinos came, and then they let the riverboat casinos turn into land base, and it is just tough to compete against casinos.
So gamblers are not specifically, a lot of gamblers are not specifically attached to betting on dogs. They're just betting on whatever, gaming.
Well, gaming slot machines are a lot easier. You just pull the handle, whereas you come and when you're betting on dogs, you have to, you know, look at the program, you have to handicap it a little bit and try to figure out. But I will say the difference between us and a casino is you can bring your whole family down here and watch the races, and the kids love watching the races. And I think it's a little bit different than the casino business, because you can't bring children, obviously, into the casino. But here you can bring your whole family down and enjoy the races, and you don't have to spend as much money. And I don't think you end up losing as fast as you can in a casino.
Mm-hmm. How has attendance been the last few years at the Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque?
It's been going up, and we've also, our handle's been going up, too, our off-track handle. We switched around post time to attempt to see to get our handles better and to do a little more competing against across the country. So we were already up. We were up $2.1 million compared to last year on our simulcast that's betting on our live handle across the country.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there may be a silver lining in Iowa for the with this news out of Florida phasing out their Greyhound racing. Do you think some enthusiasts will make Iowa a stop?
Well, I mean, I hate to see Florida, what happened in Florida. In reality, I guess we really won't truly know what effects we have in at least 2 more years. Like Jim said, there's 8 more tracks that are still going to keep running for 2 more years. And after that, then I guess we kind of will see the results of what will start happening. I think our handle will increase a little bit, but at this time I really don't know for sure how much we will see until the next 2 years is over with.
Mm-hmm. Brian, how many kennels like Jason Hess's Extreme Hess Racing Kennel are there in Iowa?
Well, we have here, we booked nine kennels here, and eight of the nine are Iowa bred kennels. Dog farms at this time, I do not know. The Department of Agriculture could tell you how many dog farms are in the state of Iowa, but at this time, I got to admit, I don't know offhand.
Mm-hmm. Jim Gartland, from a national perspective, tell us your view on when tracks started closing, when the controversy about dog racing really started across the country.
Well, at one time, there were 63 racetracks active in the United States, and over the years, many have closed due to, like, mostly what Brian said, the competition from what I call dumber forms of gaming, casino gaming mostly. People are a little bit too lazy to read a program and study the book, and you see the same thing in horse racing, which is even much slower than greyhound racing. So the decline in pari-mutuel has gone just because of that. It's a bit slower. It takes a little more work than any, many other forms of online gaming or casino gaming. And as well as, but on the other hand, if people understood, it's the most purest form of gaming, because about 80% of all the money's bet is returned in the form of winnings, as opposed to a casino where it's only like 10%, or a lottery where it's less than 50%. So I don't really understand that, but it hasn't all been attributed to the animal rights issues especially. That isn't the case. It's been for the competition and the new generation's need for quick gratification.
Mm-hmm. And Florida will be missing out on some tax revenues because of this decision?
Well, there's been estimated they could lose close to $500 million a year in tax revenue. And one other thing I'd like to add that's sort of strange, while the law in Florida banned live greyhound racing, people in Florida will still be able to bet on greyhound racing from other states, which is kind of ironic. So all those tracks will not close permanently. They will probably simulcast and show and wager on greyhound races in the future.
Mm-hmm. And Brian Carpenter, there at Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque, you don't just have live races. You simulcast races from around the country?
Yes, we bring in the horses and the dogs from across the country. We have the Triple Crown here, and we also, like I said, the Florida tracks, several of them we bring in here too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Brian Carpenter, as far as you can tell, the forecast for Iowa Greyhound Park over the next few years, what would you say that forecast is like?
I'm pretty sure we'll be here for at least 4 years for sure, and then after that, I'm not sure. It's hard to know what the future will bring, but, you know, I've heard over the years, many years, of how we were coming to an end, and we're still hanging in there 34 years later, so hopefully we have many more, but we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. And Jason Hess of Extreme Hess Racing Kennels, what's the forecast for your family business of raising greyhounds?
Pretty much business as usual, just a little bit less breeding due to what's coming up shortly. And then once the dust settles and see how everything goes, it might completely change at that point. But as now, pretty much business as usual.
Mm-hmm. Jason, I've always wondered, how do you name your dogs? Do you name them at the kennel, or how are they named?
The owner of the dog names them, and it comes from about anywhere. My kids name some. I name some. You might have a favorite TV show. You name them after the characters in there. Some of the dogs will give their own name by their personality and the way they act. They just kind of have their own. It all varies.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some names, some dogs that come to mind right now when you think of past dogs you've raised there?
Yeah, I like the show Gold Rush is one of my favorite shows on the Discovery Channel. And I've named a lot of dogs after the people in Gold Rush.
Mm-hmm. Extreme, what is the name of your kennel? Is that the name of a dog as well?
That's a prefix I use for the dogs. So, like, when you look in a program, you can find them a lot easier.
I see.
Keep track of them better. And it's something I've had for about 15 years.
So any dog name with Extreme in front of it is from your kennel?
Correct.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much for giving us your perspective on the coming closures of Florida's greyhound tracks and how that may impact greyhound racing here in Iowa. Jason Hess, Extreme Hess Racing Kennel Owner, also board member of the Iowa Greyhound Association. Brian Carpenter, Director of Racing and General Manager of the Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque, and Jim Garland, Executive Director of the National Greyhound Association. Jim, Brian, go ahead quickly.
I did want to mention real quick, we do tours here at the track during live racing season for people to come in and want to see kennels and see what's going on behind the doors.
Brian Carpenter, thanks for that. Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque. Brian Carpenter, thanks again. Jim and Jason as well.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll dig into a conversation about seismology that's following last Friday's powerful earthquake in Alaska. We'll hear from an Iowan who experienced it in Alaska, also from an earth and environmental scientist. It's a chance for you to share your earthquake experience. Have you been in a significant earthquake? Tell us about it this next half hour. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Looking for earthquake stories, experiences firsthand. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.